Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter James Risen's new book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. For his efforts, especially in his previous best-selling book, State of War, he has become a target of both the Bush and Obama administrations and still faces the threat of jail time for his refusal to reveal how he found out so much information about an important story of CIA bungling. In his new book, Pay Any Price, he weaves several stories into the broadest canvas yet, a picture of how he says our endless war on terror has so corrupted us, so vastly warped the use of state power, that America is waging wars on decency and truth. It's a great pleasure to welcome James Risen to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Given what you have been through, and we'll talk about this, obviously, both with the New York Times and with the last book, what did you want to accomplish with this book in setting the record straight, I assume, and also telling people exactly where we are and how we got there?
Well, I think this book is kind of my answer to the government. They've been after me for a long time, and I wanted to show them and show the world that I'm not going away, that my answer to government's crackdown on whistleblowers and leaks and targeting journalists is that I'm going to keep doing aggressive investigative reporting, and I'm going to keep working. And so I think that's the only answer that the government would respect, and it's the only answer that would allow me to keep doing what I enjoy doing and what's my job. You know, I also felt very strongly about what's happened to the country since 9/11. It just seems like, you know, since things of the transformation of our society since 9/11 has happened so incrementally, it's difficult for us to see what's happened, what we've done to ourselves and how we've transformed our society, because we don't step back out of our daily lives usually and see what's happened. And so I thought that's really what I was trying to do.
So let's go back to 2004. You break the warrantless wiretap story, and you write the story, and yet it's almost 2 years from the time that you write the story to the time that it is printed in the New York Times. And
yeah, it was a little over a year.
Over a year.
About, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In writing the story, And knowing what, and the government knowing what you have written and what you are going to say, and the concern about that being on the front page of the New York Times, why was it so important for you to report the story, to get that story out?
Well, the people who told me and Eric Lischblau, my colleague at the New York Times, about the story were really tortured with their knowledge. They believed that there was something illegal and possibly unconstitutional going on. And it was, to me, a really crucial story for the American people to know about, because it felt like if these kind of things aren't reported, then, you know, the government will continue to abuse its power. I felt like I couldn't continue to be a reporter if I didn't have that story get out. I just didn't want to stay in the business if those kind of stories couldn't be reported.
Jill Abramson, in her 60 Minutes interview in the piece on this book and on you recently, basically said that, okay, you went out and said, I'm going to publish this in a book if you aren't going to publish it. And she admits that you forced their hand a bit.
Yeah, well, I did. Yeah, they didn't want to admit that at first, but after they killed the story a couple times, I decided to put it in State of War, and then told the editors it was going to be in State of War. So that's basically why the whole process of getting it in the paper started up again.
So meanwhile, the editors, the publishers, are called to the White House with the president and the head of the NSA, and they're saying, if anything happens, the blood's on your hands.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the editors were in a They were being told repeatedly by the White House and by the intelligence community that this was the warrantless wiretapping program was, you know, like the crown jewel of the counterterrorism program, and that it would damage national security to report this. So we, Eric and I, knew, though, that this was, there were a lot of people in the government saying this was illegal or unconstitutional. So we felt strongly that it had to be published.
Were you ever concerned that what they were saying could come to light, in the sense that something horrible could happen and the finger could be pointed at you?
Oh, not really. I mean, the government, I've, you know, covered intelligence for a long time, and the government always kind of cries wolf about potential damage from newspaper stories. And they had said this to me about other stories in the past. And I knew that you know, that their claims were largely hyped because they, you know, it's their best way to try and stop publication of stories. So I think the problem is the government has cried wolf on this kind of issue for so long that they've lost credibility. And at heart, I think there's no evidence really that any newspaper or media story in broadcast or print or whatever that's come out since 9/11 has harmed national security. You know, they always claim that it does, but there's no evidence of that.
So let's go then to why you are possibly facing prison. Refusing to reveal your source in a story which you uncovered on a botched secret CIA operation. Do you believe that this would be as big of a deal and as much of a concern if it were not for the other story? Are they related?
Yeah, actually, absolutely. I think that the only reason the government has been coming after me is because they were very, very upset and angry about the NSA domestic spying stories in the New York Times. And when my book came out a couple weeks after the New York Times story, the government began a leak investigation, first of the New York Times NSA stories and then a separate leak investigation of my book. And I know that the government eventually decided not to come after the New York Times on our NSA story. And I think that was because they didn't want a constitutional showdown with the New York Times. And so instead, I know that they went through my book chapter after chapter looking for something to start an investigation of. I know that they did leak investigations of several chapters. So I think they were trying to isolate me from the New York Times.
Isn't it pretty much the same thing going after you? I mean, obviously the New York Times is the New York Times, but you are now the face of the New York Times as the reporter who is still employed by that news organization, who is filing these stories for the New York Times.
Yeah, but I mean, it's different. I mean, it was for a book. You know, they didn't have to take on the New York Times in a face-to-face showdown. So I think that's what they ended up doing. You know, I think it would have been much more difficult for them. If they had taken on the New York Times, it would have become kind of like the Pentagon Papers, kind of a legal showdown that I think they just decided they didn't want to have the appetite for, because at the time the legality of the NSA domestic spying program was very much up in the air. And they were at the same time, they were trying to get Congress to approve new legislation to essentially endorse domestic spying, which Congress did in 2008. And that was about the same time they were subpoenaing me on the separate thing. So I think they didn't want to be having a showdown with the New York Times over the NSA spying stories at the same time they were trying to get Congress to ratify the program with new legislation.
James Risen is our guest. The book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. In the 60-minute piece that ran There's Michael Hayden, the former head of the National Security Agency, saying that he doesn't understand the necessity to pursue you, and ultimately said that he's very conflicted about this. What was your reaction to that?
I was surprised, but you know, I was pleasantly surprised that he's come around, you know, to see it differently than he did before. You know, the reason these leak investigations happen is because the intelligence community puts enormous pressure on the Justice Department to pursue them. And so after he was NSA director, he was CIA director. And I'm sure, you know, his views at the time he was in the government were probably very different than they are today. But, you know, it's what I think is that the Obama administration has taken these whistleblower and leak crackdowns much further than anybody really expected. And so it raises a lot of questions for a lot of people about what does this mean for the future of investigative reporting and for democracy.
How much did the release of the Snowden documents really, in a manner of speaking, kind of fill in the blanks of what you'd been talking about since 2004?
Right. Yeah, I mean, basically what I think Eric and I kind of disclosed the broad outlines of the NSA's domestic spying program, both in terms of their spying on the content of communications and emails, and also the fact that they were getting the call and email logging data, which is what we now call metadata. But what Snowden did, I think, the real importance of his disclosures is to show with documents how much that program had grown over the years since we wrote about it, and how the NSA had taken advantage and exploited the growth of social media and the digital online presence of Americans to, you know, and how the digital information had exploded in the last 5-6 years, and how the NSA had taken advantage of that and had grown, and its domestic surveillance programs had grown so dramatically since we first wrote about them. So I think that's the importance of what Snowden did, was to show the growth and expansion of domestic surveillance under Obama.
You won with your colleague, won a Pulitzer Prize for that warrantless wiretap story. One of the chapters in this book is about whistleblowers who try to make that story public before the Times printed it. Talk a little bit about the power of the whistleblowers in this case.
Well, in Pay Any Price, one of my heroes is Diane Rourke, who was the House Intelligence Committee staffer doing oversight of the NSA at the time in 9/11. Right after 9/11, she was told by people she knew at the NSA about the new domestic spying program, which started right after 9/11 under Bush. She never leaked to the press, but she went throughout the government to try and stop it. She went to her bosses. She went to people at the White House, went to judges. She tried to get to the Supreme Court. And then she had a very dramatic showdown with Michael Hayden, who at the time was NSA director. And she told him she thought what he was doing was wrong and it was illegal and probably unconstitutional. But she never leaked to the press. And then when after our stories ran in the New York Times a few years later, she became the prime suspect for the government because she had tried to stop it within, you know, and went within channels to try to stop it. And so the FBI raided her house and persecuted her, and her whole life was turned upside down, even though she had never leaked to the press. And so I always thought her story really tells you how difficult it would have been for Edward Snowden to do what he did and stay inside the United States, because whistleblowers, even those who stay inside the system, are punished and persecuted.
I mean, you read in the book that she went as far as to contact the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, William Rehnquist.
Yeah, Yeah, she after her meeting with Hayden, Hayden told her, you know, she asked him, why are you doing this? Basically, because she knew that there were other ways, even more effective ways to do what they wanted to do to track terrorists that would not have required them to spy on all Americans. And Hayden said, well, you know, we have the power, and which was kind of chilling to Rourke. And then he also said to her, we'll, if this ever leaks, we'll have a majority of 9. And she realized what that meant was, if it ever comes out and there's a big constitutional showdown over the legality of the program, that the Supreme Court would side with the Bush administration and say that it was legal. And she left Hayden's office determined to try to get to Chief Justice William Rehnquist first before Hayden could. And she passed a note through some intermediaries to him about it, but never heard back from him. And she then retired to Oregon, very depressed that she hadn't been able to stop the program.
There were some thoughts that she was the source of your story. You say she was not, that she did not talk to the press. Mm-hmm. You make the point in the book that this is the example that should be used. Her story is what should be used as an example when people say that and ask why Snowden didn't go through quote unquote proper channels.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she had some really chilling experiences. I mean, people she thought were her friends within the government, you know, high-ranking, powerful officials in the intelligence community who she went to try and warn them that this was going on. You know, it was like then she would have these meetings with these people and they wouldn't respond to her or they would be quiet. And then she would realize, oh my God, they already know about it and they're keeping their mouths shut. And she would find that at every turn, there was a conspiracy of silence already underway to protect this domestic spying program. And she even called a federal judge who was on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which was the secret court that was supposed to be approving search warrants for any eavesdropping inside the United States. And she never was able to get to the judge, but then the judge's secretary said, well, don't worry, we've told the Justice Department that you've called and asked these questions, which she felt was like a betrayal. And so at every turn throughout the government, she was told, either keep your mouth shut, or if you keep doing this, you're going to be punished. And finally, when the story did come out, the FBI, you know, went to her house in rural Oregon and raided it at 6 in the morning.
What do they know about you?
The FBI?
Yeah, have you been raided?
No, but the government is, it's come out in the court case that they've gotten a lot of my personal records, credit card reports, credit reports, travel records, phone records. So they've been targeting me for a long time.
The New York Times reports this week about the Postal Service and the monitoring of mail, and to a much larger degree than we knew, which leads to the whole point of your book, which leaves me to think that you really can't trust anybody or anything.
Well, I mean, it goes to this point that we've allowed everything to be transformed. You know, mail covers used to be something done fairly selectively by the Postal Service and by law enforcement. And now they've created a huge database of virtually every piece of mail going through the system, which is kind of like the NSA's domestic metadata program. So it's, those are the type of things that I'm writing about in the book, about how we have step by step allowed the country to create a new national security state that didn't exist before 9/11.
The subtitle of the book is Greed, Power, and Endless War. In this way of paying any price and what we are doing to get this information, I understand power. I understand how we got into this endless war because we're living it. Talk to me about the greed aspect and who is greedy, and is it financial? Is it for greedy for information, or all of the above?
Well, all of the above. I think basically what you got to remember is that, remember when Dick Cheney said the gloves come off? That really meant we were deregulating national security. It
right.
meant we were going to have counterterrorism operations basically with no real rules. And at the same time, we were pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into these new counterterrorism programs. And so the combination of deregulated national security with hundreds of billions of dollars in new funding turned Washington into a gold rush town for anybody who could claim they had a silver bullet to solve the problem of terrorism. And so lots of hustlers and con men came to Washington and said, "Hey, I know how to find Osama bin Laden, or I know how to stop the next terrorist attack." And to me, it was just, since the FBI and the CIA and all these other agencies were getting so much more money than they knew what to do with, it became very easy for lots of unintended consequences and bizarre operations to take place that never would have happened before. And lots of people realized there was a huge opportunity in Washington, both to make money and for personal advancement and career advancement, or for power, if you could claim to be an expert on counterterrorism.
Did you think, with the change of administration, when President Bush left office, that in some way that would change, that culture would change?
Yeah, I did, and I was surprised on a number of fronts that it hasn't. Both personally and my legal case, I thought the Obama administration would drop it, and they didn't. And as I write in the book, that was kind of, to me, a personal indication that the war on terror was becoming a bipartisan exercise and something that was going to be more permanent. And I think that's, to me, as I think I said in the book, I think one of Obama's major legacies is going to be that he made the war on terror permanent. A lot of these programs started under Bush and Cheney when they were kind of on an ad hoc basis, when people were kind of panicking. And I think Obama's legacy is going to be that he made them permanent. He made the war on terror more normalized. It's much more difficult to criticize the war on terror today because both parties are now deeply invested in it, both Democrats under Obama and the Republicans from the Bush era. And there's very little constituency now for skepticism in the war on terror. And that makes it very easy for people to oversell counterterrorism programs and to demand huge amounts of money for and personal, not only money, but also American troops and personnel, the sacrifices of American troops, too. So it's to me, what's missing today is enough skepticism, both from the American public and from politicians and the media, to change things.
How much do you believe that the Snowden case was a turning point for this president? Because he could have gone in another direction, mm-hmm. and changed that tone pretty quick.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a real opportunity for him to do that, and he didn't do it. He gave some speeches that sounded nice, and you know, he gave a speech saying that he thought the war on terror was going to end someday. He gave speeches all over. You know, he's given lots of talks about the need for reform, and then nothing happens as a result. And that's one of the problems, the disconnect between his rhetoric and the reality of the administration's approach to counterterrorism.
Let's talk about reality as we wrap up, and that is your case goes to trial in January, at least that is what the schedule is now. How real a possibility do you believe there is that you could serve jail time?
I don't know. I really don't know at this point. Everything's kind of up in the air, and I'm not sure what the government has planned.
How much
trial set for January? That's all I know.
How much of it do you believe it's up to the judge?
Well, of course, yeah, it is. But it's we've gone through a whole series of, you know, the legal process has gone all the way to the Supreme Court. So right now, I don't know what the next step is.
How does it affect you as a journalist, as a reporter, for the next story that you're working on for the New York Times right now? I mean, does it, obviously it hasn't made you gun shy, but it would also seem that it has to have an impact.
Well, it did, you know, at first it had more of an impact, but I've kind of gotten used to it. And as I said, you know, I just felt like I had to fight back by writing this book and putting the best stories I could find in context of what I, you know, think is, you know, this huge issue that nobody seems to be talking about, which is how we have gotten ourselves into a 13-year period of war, which is unprecedented in American history.
Do you think we will start talking about it? We talked about the opportunity with the Stone case and President Obama. Do you think other opportunities will turn this around?
Yeah, I mean, for instance, the whole issue of ISIS has to be debated. You know, we're now, the intelligence on ISIS, the summer showed that they were not considering attacks on the United States. It was not considered an imminent threat to the United States. And yet, you know, we have gotten involved in Iraq and Syria now with very little debate. And so I just think we have to be more skeptical, more open and transparent as a country about what are our goals in a period of endless war. Are we going to just have open-ended strikes in lots of countries around the world all the time? Or, you know, I just think after 13 years, we should begin to realize we can't kill our way out of the war on terror. There's other fundamental reasons why there are problems in the Middle East that we have to begin to think about.
You say in the book that your answer to this is to keep writing because you believe that if journalists ever stop uncovering abuses of power and ever stop publishing stories about those abuses, we will lose our democracy. And a two-part final question. One is, when you think of how the New York Times initially did not want to publish your story, do you think a lesson has been learned there? And given the precarious state of journalism and newspapers today, that we are in a place where not many other news organizations would do what they ultimately did?
Yeah, no, I think things have changed dramatically at the New York Times. I think our story really changed the culture to some degree at the Times. And then more recently, I think it's become, you know, that the papers has turned around on these kind of national security stories. So I think things are much better here in that regard. And, and you're right. I mean, but there's larger problems in journalism, the financial pressures that the media overall faces are enormous, and it makes it much more difficult, first of all, even to do this kind of reporting. And so there's fewer and fewer people doing it to begin with. So I think that's the biggest problem we face right now.
James Risen's new book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. James Risen, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Again, it's James Risen. His new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War, that is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.